One of the themes that we're looking at on the investment side is audio. So we invest in a company called Gimlet Media. They're a startup. They do Reply All. They do a mystery show. And part of the reason we invested there, we think they're great, but also we want to understand more about audio. We think there's sort of a podcast renaissance happening, and we thought that about a year and a half ago when we made that investment. I always liked building stuff. So I don't know an engineer who didn't like play with Legos. So when I was 10 years old, I was probably building that kind of stuff. And pretty early on, I liked seeing what people were willing to pay for different things. So probably not at 10, but like at 15, I had I started this small business with a friend because I wasn't old enough to drive. So I partnered with a friend who could drive, and we had a delivery service to our pool. Made flyers, and I was told I wasn't charging up for delivery, and I believe that was right. But basically, I was like, these parents have to leave to go get food, and they have to leave their kids at the pool. So what if I come and just say, I'll go pick up your food and bring it back? So we did that. And I basically went around to our local mall and got discounts from all of the restaurants. I got either 10 to 20% off. So I made the difference. So I charged for delivery, and then I charged the regular price. So I got 10 to 20% of each order. Which actually turns out to be about what seamless economics are, and then the delivery fee. So I to some degree, I always liked that. And then also around the same time, or a little bit earlier, when I was like 13, so between 10 and 15, I started programming, I think. And that was like with QBasic at the time. I have a very distinct memory of being like, I can change what is on this thing that Bill Gates made. Like, that's kind of how I thought about it. Like, I can control what's on there. So I'd make, like, games and stuff, just for myself, not for anybody. And it was a long time before I kind of, in retrospect, probably thought about it a little bit more as an art project. And so, therefore, didn't really share it with anybody. If that makes sense? I wasn't, like, making it for other people. Kind of like with how you were describing the podcast earlier. It's like, I wasn't making it for any other audience other than myself. And I was sort of embarrassed. Like, I was sort of put enough into it where I was like worried about other people thought of it. If that makes sense. So it wasn't until probably college that I built something that I like showed other people that like other people used. I went to college. I studied computer science and cognitive science. So the computer science is mostly, I'm not like a great computer scientist, like I can hack stuff together. But I liked the cognitive science. I liked taking how people think and applying it to computers and to how computers think and applying it to people, which I feel like is what cognitive science is. So there was like a little bit of an artificial intelligence component. There was a little bit of a linguistics component. My independent study was I'd call it now an app. It was like kind of a website. For the Hebrew department, I had taken Hebrew as my foreign language. Okay. Just like I was interested in learning it, and I had taken Spanish in high school, and I was kind of curious about learning it. And I ended up building this thing that was I had an observation in high school about math, which was there was this test that I took. I remember really clearly where I didn't understand radians, and I understood everything else. So I decided I'm just gonna not learn about radians, but I'm going to make sure I get 100% on the rest of it. I know that's only 10% of the grade. And like I did that almost exactly. So the letter grade I got was an A. It was 90%, 91%, something like that. But the entire last part of the section I got wrong. My thought was like, I don't think she was the teacher was that great at teaching that stuff. And I was curious whether other students felt the same way. And so kind of applied that logic to Hebrew where I think like sort of there's some similarities between math and language. Where it was like, you can actually walk people through. So it was basically this quiz. You'd go through and you'd take the quiz, and the teachers would create the questions. And it was basically fill-in-the-blank questions where there's multiple choice. And if you got it wrong, it would walk you through how to get to the right answer. And so it would be like, is this past tense or future tense? You'd pick. Is the subject a masculine or feminine? You'd pick. And in Hebrew, what happens is like the past third person masculine is the same as the future tense first person. So you could get the question wrong, but for lots of different reasons. And so I had taken this quiz at some point, and I got the question wrong because I thought the gender was a certain way. And I was wrong. And so they were like, well, you're, so I knew how to conjugate, I was conjugating it properly given that I knew that. And so what I did was I made this program, which I think in retrospect was actually kind of a cool idea. It was a little early, but it was basically this dynamic testing product where you could adaptive learning, I think it's what it's called now. You'd go through like 10 or 20 or 30 questions, and then it would aggregate all the classroom data. And it would say to the teacher, okay, here's what, like X percent of the people don't know how to, got things wrong because they didn't understand the gender. Y percent of people got things wrong because they didn't understand how to conjugate in the future. So hopefully the teacher could come in the next day and actually be able to teach to what people were understanding and not understanding. I thought that'd be kind of cool. The context is that it was in like 2003. And so the friction I would run into is I would go into the professor's, this is in college now, so the professor's office and be like, hey, why aren't you using this? And she was like, I don't understand how to get to it. She didn't know that you'd open up Internet Explorer and go to a website. So I made like a shortcut and put it on the desktop, and then they started using it. So like that was sort of like understanding the user interaction is as important as the product. It's like the product is has got to have that low friction at all the points. And so then they started using it. So that's kind of cool. But kind of took that with me through. So anyway, that was in college. And then I worked at a company. My first job was a company called Trammell Crow. I was in Philadelphia. I worked there for a while. For about 5 years, I built their technology platforms. I worked at this real estate company. Then I worked at a company called, I wanted to do more consumer tech. Worked at a company called Hot Potato that was building a consumer social network. That company got acquired within, I think, 9 months by Facebook. So it was a very quick, I got to see all the parts of a startup kind of in a compressed way, but also we didn't really have the opportunity to scale it up. It was, again, retrospect, what people are now calling like an acqui-hire. They wanted, like they said, okay, you're solving an interesting problem here, but want to do it with, at the time, 500 million people. And so everybody, the team kind of scattered. So people, some people went to VC, some people, one guy started another company, a couple people went to other startups. Some people came here to Betaworks. I went back to business school, finished up, and then I started a company called ReferBoost, which is basically a literal mashup between real estate and social media. So I learned how to get people to click on stuff. I learned a little bit about real estate industry. And so I built this product, what it became was sort of a way for apartments to get verified reviews from their residents, which was fine. We got distribution through apartments.com, which was great. So we're in buildings all over the country. I moved back to New York and I also launched this like side project. It was a gifting app that was used by a lot of the like fun consumer brands like Birchbox and Warby Parker and Uber all had used it at some point for customer acquisition, which was like a fun, interesting, like more the types of companies that I like to work with, like these early companies, as opposed to explaining to a property manager, here's what a Facebook timeline is. Like that wasn't as much of it felt more like sales and less like sort of an interesting conversation when learning about how they're thinking about the world. So I ended up coming back here and kind of looking for the next thing. And I got connected with Betaworks and then joined to do seed investments. And so I've been here for about almost 2 years. So I've done about 20 investments. When I first talked to John, he asked me a similar question, which is like, who are your kind of intellectual people that you follow, I guess. I mean, I certainly think Elon Musk is awesome. I kind of break it down into people who are amazing. These aren't mutually exclusive, but people who are great at execution and people who are great at philosophy and like intellectual conversations around it. And so there's a bunch of people who are awesome operators that are building businesses that are, for lack of a better word, like in boring industries. They're doing like they're sort of like, here's the business playbook. They build big businesses. That's different than some of the companies often that we're investing in, which are hypothesis, like consumer behavior hypotheses that can be disproven, if that makes sense. So Don Norman is one guy who I really like, who was a professor when I was at Northwestern. He ran the program that I was in. He wrote a book called Design of Everyday Things. And the way that he thinks about products, I think, is it's sort of customer-centric, and then he sort of later on went back again, I sort of had a disagreement with his former self about how he should think about how people should think about products. But I don't know. I'd heard that like maybe Google was based on it. It's basically around simplicity, understanding form and function, how those things work together. So I think he's one person that I kind of think about, or has influenced me, I guess. Who else? You know, someone like Elon Musk. I think Peter Thiel, like his book Zero to One, I think is put words to a lot of thoughts that I had. So I don't know if they're, I think sometimes you have these like germs of ideas, and then finding people who have already kind of introspected about them and hearing how they think about them is really useful. So there's three books that I think are awesome, and two books that are part of a three-part trilogy, in my view. I don't think other people describe them this way. The first, which isn't a book, is Kahneman and Tversky did a bunch of research in the 70s, all the psychological research that was like basically the foundation of what became behavioral economics. So that's not a book, but that's like kind of stage one. Stage two is there's a guy who wrote a book, his name's Robert Cialdini, who wrote a book called The Psychology of Influence, I think. Which takes a bunch of the lessons learned in Kahneman and Tversky and puts them into ways that you can think about the world. And so it's like, I don't know if he coined the word social proof, but things like social proof. The research suggested that people want other people's approval, and so he kind of took all that research and said, okay, well, that's like people basically are social animals and want to coalesce around certain things and care about what other people think is interesting. And then the third book is... by Dan, I think his last name is pronounced Ariely, which is Predictably Irrational. So that one is, to me, then takes what Cialdini did and says, okay, how do we apply this to actual business and where do we see it in the world already? And so I think those are kind of, I think it's interesting that just from a psychological perspective, you can see how people have gone from like researching people to sort of starting to understand them to actually applying it. So we do two things at BetaWorks. We have the studio where we're building new products. So I think most of the interviews you've done are with people who are working on individual companies that BetaWorks has a significant stake in, is almost co-founders of in many cases. The second thing we do at BetaWorks, which is much smaller by headcount, but larger in terms of number of times we've done it, is seed investing. And so when I joined, it was John and me doing seed investments. We now have a team of four people, including John and me. So we hired Anna, who works with me here, and then a guy named Peter, who's in California. Peter Rojas. So he started in Gadget, Gizmodo, he's awesome. The way that we spend our time is a mix of meeting new companies and supporting companies we invest in. And that's kind of basically the two functions, or helping the companies we invest in. And I used to say that, like, for companies we're investing in, when it was just me, I was like, if you take the 100 investments we've done and divide it up by my time, like, that's not how you should think about our value add. Our value adds is we have a very specific focus on consumer media broadly, but sort of specifically on these areas of kind of connected APIs and messaging systems and companies that connect with each other. They're usually clusters of companies that end up working together. And so that's where our value should be, is that we're building and investing in things that are really relevant to you. So you can actually, anything from business development all the way down to like data relationships should be kind of the reason that you want BetaWorks to be an investor. So I spend my day-to-day is meeting with new companies and then trying to find that connective tissue, those different points. Whenever we meet with someone new, it's who, and it's not always new companies. We meet with people who are in media. We meet with people who are building new products. But also with established companies. So that's the other half of it, is trying to help companies grow and solve their own problems. A simple example is, we were a seed investor in If This Then That. Do you know them?
Mm-hmm.
So a company that connects APIs together. We had built a bunch of products. We were starting to see that APIs are really relevant. And this actually predates me. So I'll say we, but it's actually was John and whoever was working on investments at that time, which I'm not sure exactly when
that
was.
Anna,
yeah.
Who's that?
I'll introduce you to her. She just joined. She's graduated from college, and she's been here about 4 or 5 months.
Must have missed her enrollment.
You should interview her. She's awesome. So, and I'm sure she'll bring a different perspective. I mean, this is my view of investments. So with If This Then That, we had built something sort of similar, but ended up pivoting into Bitly. And so we knew there was this interest in being able to dynamically do things on the internet and connect these different services that are now all starting to become open together. So in IFT pitch, they go by If This and That, IFTTT. So sometimes we just call them IFT. We didn't say to them, hey, we're going to build a bunch of channels for you, a bunch of services that are API connected. But I think they understood that we understood what they were doing. And so now if you look at, it's sort of more correlation than causality, I think. If you look at the If This Then That most popular channels, we've built or invested in probably the top 10, if not more of them. So there's a GIF channel, there's a Dig channel, there's, you know, it is a Bitly channel, because we're interested in APIs. Not because we're like, oh, we gotta do this thing for IFT. It's because we have this focus on connecting APIs together as part of our general DNA at Betaworks. So that's sort of one very straightforward example. So there's nothing that would change, because I feel like I'm happy where I am, and so you get there the way you get there. At some point I realized this, and I don't know when it was exactly. I think it was sort of weirdly in business school, which is kind of ironic, but it was that the perception of riskiness of startups versus sort of having a corporate job, I think is, the perception is different than the reality. So in a pre-2008 crash world, it's like, well, you're gonna go do, like, there was no real, I'm sure there was a startup ecosystem, I wasn't part of it. And the perception for me was, oh, that's going out and doing something that's really, really risky. This, for lack of a better word, much less risky or safer option is to go get a job. I think that post 2008, when a lot of people who were kind of my age, who had kind of seen, we missed the 2001 crash because we were in college, so we didn't really experience it, but then we very much experienced the 2008 recession. We're like, hang on a second, like, are these the quote unquote like jobs, are those really that much safer? Because I will tell you that when I lost, when I was doing my company and I lost a customer, it didn't mean, like, a customer fired me, right? In that way, right? If they say we're not going to pay, or even if they didn't convert into a paid customer, that was only one over the number of customers I had. So I didn't like lose my job, right? Whereas like if your boss decides that, or if your company's downsizing, like that's a kind of a binary thing. And so I think that my perception of the risks of doing a startup, which I think is always the thing that I knew I wanted to do, was the perception was higher. And so I would have told myself, like, it's not this end of the world risk. Just if you want to try to do something, like, figure out how to do it.